tiny in all that air. The Philip Larkin Society Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Tiny and All That Air, the Philip Larkin Society podcast. My name is Lynn Lockwood and I am the Deputy Chair of the Philip Larkin Society. My guests today have joined me before on the podcast and I'm really pleased they're back again. We've met Philip Pullen many times already, but Chris Sewer is making his second appearance. We first met him in June 2020 when he joined us to talk about winning the Philip Larkin Prize for Poetry in the 2019 East Riding Poetry Competition. We're all very glad that he's kept in touch and is now involved with many different aspects of the society. Today, Chris tells us a little bit about how his writing has developed in some exciting new directions. We also discuss the PLS YouTube account and a new project that Chris and Phil are working on. And finally, we look ahead to the PLS Conference 24 at the University of Hull, March 14 to 15th next year, and get ourselves acquainted with some of the poems from Philip Larkin's final collection, High Windows.
I'm a trustee of the Philip Larkin Society. I'm chair of Larkin 100, which was the organisation, charitable organisation we set up to promote the centenary last year. And I'm also looking after the Philip Larkin Society YouTube channel.
Hi, and I'm Chris Sewer. I'm a writer living in Beverley. I've been writing for over 25 years and have just been awarded my MA in creative writing in 2022. I suppose my connection with Larkin comes from winning the Larkin-sponsored Poetry Prize in 2019 as part of the East Riding Festival of Words competition. And from that, I seem to have been tipped headfirst into the giddy world of Larkin. So recently I've been a performer at one of the Larkin Society's Evenings of Poetry and Music, A Joyous Shot, which was brilliantly produced by Phil, and now starting to contribute to the Larkin Society's YouTube channel. Yeah. Again, filmed by Phil.
Yeah.
and we both live in Beverley, Chris, which is very handy.
Yes, we both live in Beverley. So not only winning the competition tipped me into Larkin, mm-hmm. I was also right up to my neck in Larkin, Larkinalia and Larkin paraphernalia in this area.
Yeah, but we've sort of raised the profile of Beverley in the last few years. I think it's down to you two, basically.
Yeah, certainly has, I think, actually. Yeah. And I mean, as you know, Larkin loved Beverley, so it's great that we've got Beverley on the map, so to speak.
Absolutely, definitely.
Yeah. So congratulations on your MA.
Thank you.
Are you very proud of that?
I'm very proud and also very pleased that it's now in the rear view mirror. Because it's always, I don't class myself as a very proficient student. The technical side of it, the academic side of it is always something of a grind for me. Although, ironically, something of a pleasure when receiving the results back. So something's going on there. But yes, it's really pleased. And I did it through the Open University.
Fantastic.
And when I moved up to Beverley, I was thinking of perhaps doing something face-to-face, but then lockdown happened. So I thought I'd stick with the organisation that knows how to do distance learning, and I'm pleased that I did, yeah. I specialised in short fiction, though, not poetry, ironically. That was really good for my discipline. Mm.
So did you write a collection of short stories for your dissertation?
Yes, and what I tried to do, because I'm in terms of writing over those 2 or 3 years, I've started to become very influenced by flash fiction, shorter fiction. So some examples were like Kit DeWall, who's sort of fairly well known as, well, very well known as a writer. My name is Leon.
I love that. Great book.
Her short stories are exceptional. And she produced a fantastic collection called Supporting Cast, which takes the characters from her novels and other short stories who've perhaps only received one line or one paragraph, and then she flips them into either short pieces of flash fiction or short stories themselves. And that really keys into my interest in the peripheral, and I have to say within my poetry as well, the sort the sideline, the people on the edges, not the big fancy Hollywood type people, but just the ordinary people. And she sort of takes that and sort of takes them into the extraordinary. So it was a short, yes, it was a collection of shorter pieces that linked together as well. So it was, I pitched it as a novella in flash. And it was all set in a self-storage facility. So, which I think has the potential to, what's going on behind the shutters?
Yeah.
What's stored there?
Yeah.
What's the secrets? What's the ordinary stuff that's there but tells a massive story? Mm-hmm. So they were all standalone short stories, but they all had some connection, be it quite a large or short, with the self-storage facility. And I'm hoping that eventually I can try and expand that into a proper novella in flash. Mm. So, yeah. And I think just one other influence on that was Sarah Morris, I think her name is, a story called Summer Water. It was a novel a couple of years ago, but again, all set in a caravan, sort of like a park up in the Lake District, lodges, caravans. And each story could have been read as standalone, but they all eventually built to a climax. I think the other thing I'm saying there is that I haven't got it in me to write a novel.
Well, neither was it for Larkin in the end, was it?
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. And your poetry, though, is quite influenced by Larkin and often about Larkin.
Yes. I think I wouldn't have thought it was influenced by Larkin until I started. And I think I need to say here that, you know, I wasn't a student or an admirer of Larkin's work, because I didn't read a lot of it. When I left school, you know, not an academic at all. I hadn't studied any really form of poetry. And if I had, it's long forgotten. And so he only really came into my conscious in the last few years, and I'm really pleased that he has. And I think there's room for the newer aficionados as well as the older ones. And what I think about his poetry, and I think this applies to all poetry that I like, is again, it tends to deal with the ordinary, but make it through his use of language, and, you know, the vision that he has in a poem, he makes it into the extraordinary. And whilst I don't attain to be at Larkin standard, that's the sort of template I set for myself when I write anything, to try and take the ordinary. And I often use stuff from my own life, and from, particularly at the moment, from my past and my family, to write something that an old tutor of mine would say takes the leap, and takes it from that average to something a bit special. Yeah. You know, really difficult to quantify, I might add, sometimes.
Yeah.
But in terms of like being influenced by Larkin, I think there's other influences, and I'm happy just to mention those at the moment if you want. Simon Armitage, I think, again, is a poet that writes, you know, about ordinary subjects, but just takes them into the realms of something special.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I've been lucky to do, through the poetry business in the north of England, they do a lot of online poetry workshops. And I, since finishing my MA, I've missed that interaction, that workshop. So they've been running a series of workshops with some excellent poets, Rachel Long, Jonathan Edwards, are two really influential, I think, on me poets. Rachel was a guest, I think, a couple of years ago on one of the Philip Larkin Society's sort of webcasts or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think
yeah,
when we were in lockdown, yeah. Wasn't it?
That's with right, yes. Yeah.
And I think she really struck a chord with me then. And so, you know, I'm really into her poetry and the things that she does with it. But also Jonathan Edwards, who I just feel really does capture anyone who can write a poem with the title None on a Bicycle and make it a really good poem. Mm-hmm. He also does things with his poems that I just love his titles, which have said to me, Chris, you don't have to have obscure titles. You have to perhaps tell people a bit more in the title. So he's got titles like My Father Crashes a Car, 1965. My Father Buying Sweets, 1956. My Mother Cuts Her Arm, 1955. So I feel that a year will start to pepper all the titles of my poetry from now on. But yeah, so there's sort of influences like that coming through. And another way, I think, is anthologies for me of poetry. And really simply, I don't know whether you know, I'm going to hold this up, and I know the podcast listeners won't be able to see this, but Candlestick Press produce a series of books often called 10 Poems About Love, 10 Poems About Winter. Yeah. But they do encompass a whole range of older poetry, you know, Tennyson, Lawrence, but Monizer Alvey, those books, which are sort of retail, I'm not in their pay, $5.95 or something like that. I think they promote them as if instead of a card.
Yeah, yeah.
They have excellent range of poems in, and also poems and poets I've never read, which makes you then disappear down the rabbit hole of exploring that poet's work. So it's things like that. That are influencing me at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, they're lovely books, those, aren't they? They're available from the Beverley Bookshop, I believe.
They are available from the Beverley Bookshop and all other good bookshops as well. But yeah, Candlestick Press are just, and have actually supported the East Riding Festival of Words poetry competition over the last few years by providing a range available.
Yeah, I think we were very lucky to get Rachel Long, and her career's just sort of gone from strength to strength, hasn't it?
Mm. Absolutely. It's really taken off during the last couple of years, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree with what you say as well about Simon Armitage. As an English teacher, I've taught lots of his poems, and he has got this way of bringing younger readers in with those sort of contemporary everyday things, whether it's, just in the, with your family and in your house. I mean, one poem I really like by him, it's one of the early ones, the untitled ones, but I think it's the first line, I think Mother Any Distance, and it's a really short poem. It's one of the Book of Matches poems about, I presume it's Simon Armitage, I presume it's vaguely autobiographical, but it's like a young man moving out of home, and he's with his mum measuring up his new house to try and, measure up for carpets and things like that. And about realising that you need two people to measure up, because you need one person to hold the other end of the measuring tape. And so, but it's also about the distance between him and his mother sort of growing, and almost seeing
that
it.
Sounds really,
it's so beautiful.
Yes.
It's just full of lots of lovely imagery, and it's got imagery around sort of deserts and plains. And so you can sort of see, like, on a word level, it works really beautifully, but also on a kind of story, on a narrative level, it works really well. But it is just two people in a house, just measuring rooms. And I used to bring a couple of tape measures into the classroom and get kids to think about the act of measuring spaces.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and I think Simon Armitage has got lots of poems like that just yeah, really, the harmonium, the one about him and his father in the yeah. church. I just, really, really
he's
beautiful.
He's written a lovely poem about, I'm not a big cricket fan myself, but it's called The Catch. It's a very short and simple poem about that first playing, you know, in a small village cricket team and that first catch of the season. And it's just perfectly delivered.
Yeah.
If I can use a cricket phrase.
Did he bowl everyone for six with that then?
Yes. It wasn't wide, put it like that.
Yeah.
No, I did see Simon Armitage three times last year at the Larkin event with his band LYR and at the stage for Beverly event, which he headlined. And I said to him, "No, this is the third time I've seen you, Simon." He said, "Fourth time, and I called the police." So, yeah.
Excellent. Were you going to read a couple of your poems?
Yes, sure. I've thought I'd pick a couple that haven't seen the light of day for a while. When I said at the start that I've been writing poetry for a long time, I was just looking through some stuff recently, and the competitions or publications have been in. I seem to have seen them off. as is the way with poetry magazines, they come and go. But yes, I'd hope it's not anything to do with me or my poetry, but we never know, do we? Yeah, this one's called A Boy. During the day, where the stairs turn, a boy can spider his arms and legs to each wall, hang there, suspended, listen to the house, listen to the hall clock flex its fat movement, listen to the lubricated baby wedged in a royal blue pram, tug of warring with a string of painted faces, elastic tight across the hood. Up there, with the cobwebs and a coating of nicotine, a boy can go missing in fantasy as an express train judders and rolls the terrace, flips in via the Odeon to drink and brawl with Gable and Tracy in the turmoil of the San Francisco earthquake. At night, in the throttling dark, a boy will perch carefully, listen for the boots and shouts, arguments and blue fights. And in the suffocating black, know the depleted shuffle of a man on the pitch pine steps, followed tread by tread by the ale, chips and piss stench of a woman. Tread, breathe hard, tread, not feeling a boy's tears, tread, deltering maps on a cold face.
Just before we go on to the next one, this is kind of set in the 70s.
I think it's probably in the 60s or the 70s.
Yeah. It was just that image of the baby's toy, you know, stress the elastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you don't see them anymore, do you? But every
perambulator.
Yeah, they always have those things. Yeah.
My mother would say coach built perambulator.
I love it how just a little object like that can really transport you.
And that came from somebody telling me way back in the 90s, they'd been around somebody's house, terraced house, like I used to live in. And their son used to scale up the tight walls and hang,
really?
Hang there, yeah, just for the fun of it, for whatever it was. But yeah, he used to climb the walls up there. So there you go.
It's I think after the 70s, you could argue this kind of disappeared a bit, but that kind of you make your own fun, you know, because there wasn't a lot to do.
definitely.
I'm not sure about kids today really getting to the point of boredom where they decide to literally climb up the walls.
Yeah, well, there probably are climbing walls at each school now as well.
Well, that's true, yeah. Yeah, well, we just give them places to do that, don't we, rather than finding it for themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. But actually, that is a very old poem and did form the basis for one of the short stories in the collection set in the self-storage. So there you go.
Right.
Next poem I was going to do was Cartoon Kiss. Moving house, I find your course books and papers preserved in a brown box marked eggs, fragile. I sit on the step, look at the thick notes on Auden, on Wolf, study a shiny text on literature and gender. Notice you've cartooned a stick man and stick woman in each corner of each page. I flick through. Your illusions meet, shake hands, hug, kiss and touch, turn and shuffle away. I pull up my clicking knees, rest my hairy arms, turn the pages again. Fast then slow, slow, lingering over that kiss. Later, in a tiny one-bed flat, I listen to the plumbing sing, eat pickled walnuts, shuttle that kiss across my mind, settle my spine on the bed and develop images of you through dangerous chemical eyes. What can I say? Pickled walnuts in a poem.
Yeah, my mum and dad met over a jar of pickled walnuts.
Well, there you go. Yeah. And I'm glad to say that I'm hoping they didn't split up over a jar of pickled walnuts. Throughout my childhood, there was, on our landing or in my mum and dad's bedroom, a box, because my mum was a kitchen assistant, there was always a box marked eggs fragile because she'd brought the box home to store something in, usually knitting or something like that. So again, it's just that little image for me is the spark to something else.
I like the fact also the way that you've got those objects from the past almost there. There's pieces that are still around us, like you know, in notebooks and stuff like that, which have got their own memories built into them, haven't they?
And just as kids, I mean, I remember in textbooks doing little stick men, you know, playing football or something like that. And I've got a memory, although I've never pursued this, of in cornflake packets, perhaps flick books of goals, football goals.
Yeah, I remember those.
I've got an art. I spent a 6 months tour in South America in the 2004, and they were selling in Argentina quite a hefty size flick book of Maradona's goal against England in the 1986 World Cup. But I've always had a fascination for those sort of flick books. I thought they think they're fascinating things.
Yeah, they're good. They're really good. Yeah, it's a way of creating a bit of like a cartoon for yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure it's probably the way Walt Disney started. There you go.
Yeah. Did you ever sit thinking with a thousand things on your mind? Did you ever sit thinking with a thousand things on your mind? Thinking about someone who has treated you so nice and kind.
Now you've got the MA, are you going to use those letters after your name now?
It doesn't really cross my mind. shall we put it out to the podcast world? Should I? I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I didn't use the BA. The normal question is, are you going to do a PhD? Of which I go running screaming from the room. But no, what do you think?
Well, I started doing a PhD after having done a master's and then failed to complete it, so it got converted into a master's. So I've actually got two MAs after my name, which as if anyone wants two MAs. It was funny because I was thinking about, me and Gav were thinking about this last night, about all the letters that Larkin puts after his name on his letterheads. Because I think he was quite fond of his
he loved
letters.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He liked being called Dr. Larkin.
Dr. Larkin.
And I mean, of course, it was an honorary PhD that he was awarded, I think, from Belfast, actually. But he did like having that title, Dr. Larkin.
That's the best kind of PhD, isn't it? An honorary one.
Yeah, the honorary
one.
I was just reading somewhere, Becoming Rain, the Clive James. And funnily enough, on the last page is a letter to Clive James from Larkin.
Right.
And I noticed yesterday, as I was looking at this, librarian, professor, and then it just goes on.
Yeah.
with all the CHCBE, CLIT, MADLIT, and it just goes on and on. So he obviously liked his. I think the answer at Lynn is no.
Yeah, we were trying to work out what a CLIT was, and that made an unfortunate Google search last night. Companion of Literature, apparently.
Right, good. Bestowed hopefully from the palace.
Okay, so we're going to talk about YouTube then, weren't we, I think. Oh, did you want to talk about your Roger McGough event, actually?
Oh, yeah, it should do that.
Yes.
So that's coming up in February in Beverley, is that
that's right,
is that in
yes. So as I mentioned at the start in the introduction, I was really pleased and to be involved with the Joyous Shot event at the East Riding Theatre, where Phil and the Philip Larkin Society had created a lot of events, as you mentioned, Lynn, that sort of put Larkin's association with Beverley on the map. Fantastic exhibition, and I'm sure you've talked about that before, but that event was really interesting for me because, first of all, it's the first time I've done a performance of my poetry for quite a long time, and it's sort of a little bit of a match under me because, yeah, previously to that, where I've been to some poetry events, and Sandra, my partner, had said, you know, you should be doing your stuff here, and you know, and then Phil asked me to do it, and I really enjoyed it. We had a good feedback, you know, that helps. And from that, I know Phil was contacted by the organisers of Stage for Beverley to possibly suggest somebody to do some poetry at the event next year. So thank you again, Phil, for sort of recommending for that. So, yeah, from that, I think I'm listed on the website as Festival Poet. I'm not quite sure what that means at the moment. But I'm running a writing workshop, which, you know, I think perhaps when the podcast goes out, you can perhaps put a link, to the Stage for Beverley. And taking part. So the writing workshop is with a theme. I like a theme. So hopefully people who attend will be able to write a short poem that they can then perform if they want at the launch event for the Stage for Beverley. And just as an aside on that, the Stage for Beverley is mainly a music festival that takes place in February every year, but it does have some spoken word element. So in the last year, they had John Hegley, the poet, on as a headliner, and the year before they had Simon Armitage on. So, you know, that's two pretty good performers.
Yeah, they're the big beasts, aren't they? The big beasts.
Yeah, and two great events. Yeah. So, and from that, they've got Roger McGough this year, and I've been asked to be his support, or his warm-up, I think somebody said the other day. But, yeah, so that's really, really exciting, amazing to be involved in, and an opportunity for me. It's an honour to be asked to do it. I don't think Roger McGough knows too much about me at the moment, and that's fine. But it's and his event's on Saturday, the 17th of February. It's interesting. It's at the Tolgavel United Reformed Church in Beverley, and it's part of his Alive and Gigging tour. Whether that's an extensive tour, I don't know, but I'm really honoured to be asked to do that. And as I say, it's a really nice opportunity to do more performance, and I'm really looking forward to it as well.
Yeah, and that's a great venue, actually, the Tolgavel Methodist Church. You know, it'll be good. I've seen Ian McMillan there, and he was brilliant.
It suits you
down to the ground, I think.
Please do that. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting. So I'm really looking forward to that. Thank you.
Oh, that'd be great. And I've seen Roger McGough live once, and he was excellent. Such a great communicator. Really enjoyable.
Well, it's just that thing from my childhood. Of course, you know, it was the scaffold.
Sure. Yeah. and of course, there is a connection with Larkin as well, isn't there? As McGough was at Hull University
as well.
And Larkin at the time
wrote to him, didn't he, and asked for some advice stuff. And then, of course, there's the Merseyside stuff. But I was, you know, 5 or 6 years old when all that was kicking around. But I have got my reissued copy from the 80s or the 90s. So I'll be asking him to sign it, if if you know, you might say, no, you're getting a fee for this. Go away, you know.
But he's been
a, thank yeah. you.
He's just been such a great ambassador for poetry, hasn't he? Like, for a lot of people, he's the only poet they might even know much about. And, you know, his voice is so recognisable. And, I think it will be a fantastic night. Yeah.
Great event.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to talk about, the YouTube now, which I think is really getting a little bit of momentum. I think it's really starting to build, isn't it, Phil?
I think it is. We'd like a lot more subscribers to it, because if you subscribe to the YouTube channel, it doesn't cost you any money, but it means that you get alerted to when our videos are, you know, up and coming. We've got 98 videos up there now, so it's starting, as you say, to get some momentum. And I think it's got a lot of potential for doing more, really. It's a good way, for example, of being able to cover PLS events that people might not have been able to attend for one reason or another. For example, one of the videos we put up this year was the switching on of the Victoria Road fountain in the avenues in Hull, which was something that Jean Hartley, Larkin's publisher and great friend, was involved with, and it has a Larkin quote around the base of that. We put a film up about that. The online conversation between Andrew Motion and Blake Morrison is up there. Yes. So again, you know, that's a great opportunity to see something that we've done. All the podcasts are. So we've got another sort of outlet for that, plus a number of the other talks that we've been doing over the last few years. So I think it's got a momentum, as you say, and I think it's got potential for doing, you know, other things. So we've got one or two projects, or sort of longer term projects, that we've just started work on now. One of which Chris has been involved in, as I think he mentioned. I'm doing something around the Larkin Trail, which I know a lot of people who are keen on Larkin will have been on if they've been to Hull. It's a very special feature, I think, of Hull. I mean, it's actually probably now listed as a sort of tourist attraction of the city. It certainly was promoted during Larkin 100 last year by TransPennine Express, for example, who used it as one of the reasons to come to Hull. If I say a little bit about the background to it, it was set up, or commissioned at least, in 2010, which is part of Larkin 25, which was the great festival celebrating the 25th anniversary of Larkin's death. It didn't actually open until 2011 because I wanted to problems with getting permissions, etc. But it opened in 2011. There are 25 signs which are based around Hull city centre and parts of East Yorkshire, split into three parts geographically. But actually, there's a linear feeling to the walk as well, the trail as well. It goes basically from west to east, which if you think of it, it's following the line of Larkin's poem Here, really. Though I don't think people generally do it that way. They sort of take one section, either the city centre or outside. It's got a really nice booklet that goes with it. And there's a website too, which is very rich in content, which I don't think people are always aware of. But I thought it would be a good idea to kind of revisit it, really. Have a look at each of the signs on the trail and do something associated with it. Now, as it happens, one of the signs is in Beverley. And so we've made a start on that one. Larkin used to come to Beverley quite often. He came not only for shopping, but also to dine at the Beverley Arms and so on. And it was a place that he really enjoyed coming to. Started work on a little bit of film about that and about Larkin's connections to Beverley. And we've just done the first part of it, really, with Chris. It was a great opportunity for Chris to read his poem, which is based on Larkin's visits to Beverley. Today I cycled to Beverley. So if you go onto the website now, the YouTube channel now, you'll see Chris reading that poem as part of what will be a longer feature.
Okay.
So that's something that's going on over the year. And I'd quite like a lot of other people to get involved in that, really. So I think we put out a call, didn't we, through the members of the Larkin Society to invite any of them to come along and do something for us if they want to. If there's something like a poem they would want to read or something that they think is associated with a particular part of the trail, then we could do a feature on that.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping to, you know, engage as many people as possible in doing something.
Be nice then, Philly, I assume what you're saying is to have a sort of video link for each plaque or
that's what we're going to do. We're going to have a kind of overview of what the trail's about, and then as you say, a link for each of the plaques. I don't think that's going to be done overnight, though. I think it'll probably take about a year to get there. I probably would think about releasing those on a kind of piece by piece basis. But it will take a good while to get all 25 plaques covered, particularly as one or two of them have gone missing at the moment.
Have they?
Well, we know they've gone missing for a reason, like the one on City Hall, because of some work that was being done there, but we need to get it back in place.
And the technical nuts and bolts of that, Phil, could somebody like film themselves, like I know Lynn's done for other things?
Sure. I mean, you know, we can then blend that in. Absolutely. They don't have to wait for me to come along and film them. They can do it in whatever way they like.
Absolutely,
I think that's
one
of it's the great thing about the YouTube channel is it now enables people to come in from different angles on something to do with Larkin. And, you know, I think that makes it very powerful, really.
Yeah, I think we'd love people just to, you know, take themselves somewhere, or even if they just find themselves somewhere a little bit off the cuff and they've got the mobile phone and they want to have a go at talking about, you know, how it makes them feel, or, you know, their impressions of the place. Yeah. It doesn't have to be anything like very heavily researched or, you know, I'd love to see much more of that. And I think YouTube is really good for that kind of content.
I think it would bring the Larkin Trail even more to life. I mean, I've done quite a bit of it, but that's a really nice thing.
I think what's really great about it too is that the trail is associated with different parts of Hull's history as well. So, for example, there's one trail on Newland Avenue, which is close to where Larkin lived, and he would wander around Newland Avenue. It's a student area still, really. He'd wander around there to do his shopping, etc. And on the junction with Sharp Street, there is opposite the Larkin Memorial, opposite the Larkin plaque is a memorial about the First World War and the men from Sharp Street and other parts of Hull who joined the PALS regiments. A lot of them were from Sharp Street itself. You know, they were recruited because they had something in common. It was felt to be a good thing to be with your pals, as it were, going to war. But of course, the downside of that was many of them from the same area were killed. And that plaque is also has a little section from Larkin's poem 1914. And just in that context, I'm also planning to do something, hopefully, for YouTube based on the article that I've just had published in the latest about Larkin, about Larkin's connection with the First World War.
Oh, the two guys that went.
The two soldiers.
The
two soldiers who were billeted with Larkin's parents in Doncaster in 1914. I'm hoping to do something kind of an extended story about those two soldiers, hopefully by next Sunday, which is Armistice Day.
Right.
Well, you'll know whether it's happened because this podcast will go out after that. But the plan is, whether it gets there then, maybe a little bit later, that's another little project that I have in mind. So it's beginning to grow. And the more people's ideas that we've got for this, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. And if people want to contribute anything to our YouTube account, it doesn't have to be the Larkin Trail either. You know, there's
no, it doesn't.
And
no.
You know, when I was up in Haworth earlier on this year, and I just thought I'd go up, you know, we always go and visit Sylvia Plath's grave up at Hepton Stall. You know, that Larkin's essay about Sylvia Plath is just, I find it quite a fascinating read. And it was just nice to be able to go and talk about that up there. So it's those kind of things, and
Yeah, and I think that's a good example of how it connects to other things. I mean, you've had, as you'll know, you've got lots of views for that particular YouTube video, because I think people look at it and there's a link in with Plath, so there's a load of people who would want to watch it for Plath as much as Larkin.
Yeah.
And the more we can connect all these things together, the better.
Yeah, definitely.
That's quite interesting. In terms of that essay on Plath, I'm not fully aware of that. So maybe you perhaps, where would that be available for people to find?
So that's one of his, it's collected in required writing. So it's called Horror Poet. And it's a kind of reflection on the collected poems of Sylvia Plath that Ted Hughes had published after she died. Yes, and it sort of, Larkin reflects on, he finds the content of Plath problematic, really, the kind of the horror of the content. But of course, you know, there's horror in Larkin as well, which, you know, he doesn't kind of look at his own poetry particularly in that essay. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because I think they're so different as poets, Plath and Larkin, polar opposites, aren't they? And also the stories about Larkin's slightly kind of acerbic attitude towards Ted Hughes. You know, I love that letter where he calls him, you know, the present, looking like a present from Easter Island. The old crow, he calls him. there's so many interesting ways into Larkin. And every time you talk to somebody that knows something about Larkin, you find a new way in, don't you? And it'd be lovely to capture some of those.
So, we recorded the video. If you go to it on YouTube, outside the Beverly Arms, and it features film of Beverly as well. Perfectly put together by Phil, I'd say.
Well, we're learning.
And it's called Today I Cycle to Beverly. I'm here, hand on hotel wall, a future space for a modest memorial. Across the road, Alice laughs, hidden somewhere in the walls of St. Mary's Church, sullen behind rabbits, dearest bun. And who would think, would you, that I would stand in this spot, our future spot, contemplating afternoon tea, bicycle clips stowed in my jacket pocket. I'd like to offer you a cup, see if the saucer would remain dry, or if the droplets of the brew would puddle in its indent. After, we can walk through Saturday Market, find a bookshop, what hope, maybe take photographs in front of the Minster, or pedal out to the Holderness Plain to become something else, to slip off our coats and inhale the wide open sky.
That's quite a Larkin-esque poem, I think, isn't it?
I think some people might say a rip-off. But yes, obviously, you know, his influence tells, and I wanted to get all those little reference there. Yeah. I mean, it's in about Larkin. I'm expecting it to come as a download soon. It's just going to be a multimedia experience. But yeah, I really, and can I just say on that, I really enjoyed writing that poem. Yeah. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. It's a lovely, like a jigsaw puzzle with references.
Yeah, that sort of tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, I like the jigsaw puzzle, yes.
I think that's a good idea. A good suggestion of it being a jigsaw puzzle, really, because if you want to fully understand that poem, at one level anyway, you need to know one or two of those references are about, don't you? So you need to turn back to a much earlier version, issue of About Larkin, where I talk about Larkin's trips to Beverly.
Yes. I mean, if anyone does know the full details of it, can they let me know? I'm only the
But I do like, you know, ending a poem looking up into the sky. I know Larkin did it, but I'm sure he wasn't the first person to do it either. Just something our eyes, we look that way, don't we? It's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we're going to talk about High Windows, the collection of High Windows, because we are getting ready for the 2024 Philip Larkin Society Conference in Hull in March. And I'm hoping that both of you will play a big role in it as well. And I thought it'd be a good chance to talk a little bit about High Windows, the collection. We picked High Windows as the focus of the conference because it's the 50-year anniversary. It is also the 60-year anniversary of Whitsun Weddings, but I think Whitsun Weddings gets quite a lot of publicity on itself.
It does.
I think High Windows, you know, we've taken the quote from Andrew Motion where he describes it in his biography of Philip Larkin as something more fidgety and various. And I love the way that Motion writes about Larkin. He just has some very interesting ways of expressing his thoughts. And I love that idea of it being fidgety as a collection. I think it works.
It's a great word.
Great word. I mean, you know, he's a poet himself, isn't he, Motion? He brings that to all his writing. And so I think as well for me, High Windows is a collection that is quite off-putting to read sometimes. More, you know, Whits and Weddings is very engaging all the way through, but High Windows, it pulls you up. So I thought it would be good to just have a bit of an introduction to High Windows in this podcast, get us ready for next year. So I don't know, Phil, if you were able to give us a little bit of the context to how the writing of the collection.
Well, I mean, I think, I thought maybe sort of put it into the context of what Larkin was doing at the time. Yeah. And I think you suggested it'd be interesting to look at the period from like 64 to 74.
Yeah.
So 64 was when The Whitsun Weddings was published. And then 1974, we've got High Windows. So, I mean, one thing to note about that is it takes a long time to get a Larkin volume out, doesn't it? Really, he takes ages to get something to publication as a volume.
If I can just interject there, Phil, Clive James says in when he's doing a review of High Windows, not exactly a torrent of creativity, the best.
There you go. I think that sums it up quite well, really. But I thought, I mean, maybe because they've been in the news quite a lot recently, I would sort of start with the context of this by looking at the Beatles to some degree. Because in 1964, the Beatles were kind of getting towards the zenith, weren't they? We know from what Maeve Brennan tells us, at least, that Larkin enjoyed listening to the Beatles, or some of the Beatles. He had one or two of their albums, for example, Please Please Me, the one which finds its way into a poem. Maeve Brennan, in her autobiography, talks about Larkin falling under the sway of the Beatles, and refers to the fact that it was sufficient to give him a memorable refrain in Annus Mirabilis, which, of course, is one of the poems that he included in High Windows. You know, that famous line between the end of the Chatterley Band and the Beatles' first LP. And she talks about the 60s being very happy years for Philip and for me. That's quoting her. And she highlights some of the things which were going on in his life, the sort of happy moments, I suppose. The Whits and Weddings was a great success, and it really took him off in the poetic world, didn't it? And there was the television documentary in 64, Down Cemetery Way, with John Betjeman. So he was getting a little bit of a TV presence as well, though he didn't follow it up. And he was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry. Mm. So it was a great success. Though I think Maeve possibly overstates Larkin's happiness, because there were other things going on which were not so good for him. But actually, if we just stick with the Beatles for a minute. I don't know, I've been pondering on this, and I don't know whether this is right or not, but I like to think of the Whits and Weddings as this kind of Sergeant Pepper moment, in terms of how that hits you and the various things that are going on there and the real buzz you get from reading those poems. And with High Windows, we're more of the White Album.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we've got these bits that are much harder to get into, you know, and if you've been waiting 10 years from the Whits and Weddings for this next, you know, bit of Larkin, it's very different, isn't it, in some respects, parts of it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hold together quite in the same way. Although there's a lot in it when you get under the surface.
Unpick it, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, I think there's a degree more of unhappiness within that in some of the poems. Certainly, that image of that feeling of getting older. and friendships developing and changing. It's a period where the complications in his relationship with Monica Jones and Maeve Brennan was happening in the background. But he's also making new friendships at the time. This was the period, for example, where he was championing Barbara Pym and becoming a great friend of Barbara Pym. And interestingly, he told Pym in one letter that poetry had deserted him. So there's also this challenge that he's got with where his poetry was going. I think James Booth refers to the fact that the Wits and Weddings, if I can find it. Let me find it. Sorry. He argues that Larkin's prime blossomed and faded within the period of the Wits and Weddings poem. So after that, he was struggling much more poetically. He also redeveloped his friendship with Winifred Dawson, partly as a result of something. I think he appeared on a radio program, Larkin at 50, in 1972. Do you imagine that? I don't think that would happen now, would it? I mean, we haven't had an Armitage at 50 moment.
No.
And I don't think we'll have a Suet at 50 moment.
It's too late.
It's too late. There we go. Too late, Chris. Yeah. But Larkin, you know, there was something about him being 50 that seemed to be significant. But there were various things going on in his life that I saw the background to this. And I thought there was a telling... I've been looking at the unpublished letters to Monica for another project, and I came across something that he wrote to Monica Jones in February 1963. So this is before actually the publication of The Wits and Weddings. And he said, I spent the evening in writing exactly 10 words in about 75 minutes. The lava flow of genius. Lava, come back to me. All Larkin's, you know. But basically everything that goes on in Larkin's head and the amusement of that. But he was struggling with that. But I think probably the most important feature in his life that I think reflects some of the poetry in High Windows is the declining health of his mother, because he has such a strong relationship with his mother. And in the early 1970s, in 1972 to be exact, she went into a nursing home and quickly... began suffering from dementia, and so that connection with her was changing, fading away to some degree. And then, of course, she died in 1977, so 3 years after publication. So there was quite a lot of differing things going on in Larkin's life. And perhaps the other thing to say is that he did kind of exert this feeling that he was getting old.
He wasn't really getting old at all. He was 48, 49, 50, and...
By 1964, he was in his 40s, right? And he compared it. He literally, and I think it was in a letter to Monica Jones. He also, I remember in the tape recording he made with his mother, he refers to the 40s being the end of what he called the great fillet steak of life. He went on, after that, you're down to the poorer cuts. And so, no, he had that sense that, you know, going into the 40s, the best was over. And I think that kind of theme runs through High Windows to some extent too.
And his health was declining, wasn't it? I think there's some linked perhaps to his kind of state of mind with what was going on in the library, because the building had been completed, you know, things like computerization and, you know, his great project was kind of out of his hands now. His side of it was sort of completed and I think that there's a, you know, you could sort of argue that was quite difficult for him professionally.
Yeah. I mean, against that, of course, he it was a period where he had the sabbatical, wasn't it? So he was off to All Souls College in Oxford. And I mean, that he greatly enjoyed. Yeah. But another part of his life was slipping away from him, I guess, because when he came back to the university, to the library, his deputy, Brenda Moon, was basically running it to some degree, I guess. She was very au fait with the computerization and introduced a lot of the systems. So, it was a time of change.
And that wasn't easy for him. He's, you know, doing the Oxford English Book of British Verse and the sabbatical writing there. I mean, he knew that he was going to get criticism when that was published, whoever he included and whatever he did with that. It was a real poison chalice, wasn't it, being given that job to do. So there were certainly lots going in his life that, that didn't perhaps put him in the best frame of mind at times.
And so do you think those poems in High Windows then, Phil, do you think they are the railing against the change, the railing against the...
Well, some of them are, aren't they? I mean, if they're railing against the change in his own life, they're railing against changes in the world outside. I mean, if you take a poem like Going, Going, for example, which I think has got a real great relevance to today, maybe in a slightly different context, but, you know, this whole issue about what's happening to the environment.
The environment, yes.
It is a kind of railing poem, isn't there? And there are others in there that are equally political in that context, I guess.
And then obviously the building is, you know, his thoughts about illness and, you know, the hospital environment. And that was something that was becoming more of a reality for him, not just Eva, not just his mother.
Yeah, and even in the, you know, The Old Fools, perhaps the most terrifying poem in some degree there, I think it's more terrifying than... you know, the to come poem Obard, which you know was later on, obviously, but it's a very frightening poem, I think, that about the aging process.
Yeah.
Really.
And we've read Show Saturday before, but that, you know, it's a poem that I'm very fond of, and that's a much more nostalgic poem, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's so much going on, and there is the nature poems as well, with cutgrass and the solar. You have got those poems of, and the trees, obviously, of sort of celebration of nature and the natural world. So yeah, they're very various, as Andrew Motion says, very fidgety.
So, and if you look at the gestation time for some of these poems, they're quite long. Really, I mean, the volume came out in 74, but he'd started poems like Friday Night at the Royal Station Hotel in 1966, others in 67. How Distant was a 65 poem, Solar was a 64 poem. So there's a long period of time where these poems are being collected.
And how does that relate to, say, the poems in Whitsun Weddings then, Phil? Were they in a shorter gestation? Do you think that
they... I think I think, and if you go back to the Less Deceived volume before that, I think most of those poems were written in the short period of years that Larkin was in Belfast. And the early part of that, he'd produced a lot of poems. You know, they always sort of... came bursting out of him. So as we get to High Windows, it's struggling. And actually, there are 24 poems in High Windows. There were 32 in the Whitsun Weddings, I think. So even then, you know, he struggled to get the whole thing together in the same way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not to say that some of those poems aren't brilliant, but it's like the White Albums, to say something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, kind of appear much more than
really immediate than others.
Yeah.
Take a time.
So we're going to have a look at three poems from High Windows, and we've tried to pick poems that we haven't really talked about on the podcast before. I've certainly picked a poem that, well, I never liked, and I actually really like kind of growing to like it now, which I think is what I was hoping would happen. So, Phil, do you want to start? So you're looking at Forget What Did, aren't you? Do you want to start us off?
Yeah. Now, this is strange because I didn't know this poem at all. And it's come about in a very odd way, actually, because I had a dream about Larkin the other night. I've never had a dream of Larkin about Larkin before. This was a really powerful dream. And it had lots of those complications in it that I won't go into that, you know, happened in dreams. But at the kind of... part of it was the fact that I ended up in Larkin's study with a group of students sitting round the table, and they were talking about literary realism, which for some reason Larkin took a great interest in at some point. But he suddenly got up from behind his desk, and it isn't the office we know that Larkin actually had. It was another office in some university, and there was another desk in it. He suddenly went to the desk and started reading poetry, and I don't recall the words from this, but something in my mind told me that it was Forget What Did. So it sent me on a search for Forget What Did. And I think it's an interesting poem, actually. And going back to what we've just said about how long some of those poems took to gestate in the High Windows volume, this one actually took 19 years.
Really?
She started it way back in the 50s. Yeah. And it's a kind of, well, it's a diary poem, really, and that makes it interesting. So I'll read it and then maybe just say a little bit about it then. Very short poem. Forget What Did. Stopping the diary was a stun to memory, was a blank starting, one no longer cicatrised by such words, such actions as bleak and waking. I wanted them over, hurried to burial and looked back on, like the wars and winters missing behind the windows of an opaque childhood. And the empty pages. Should they ever be filled, let it be with observed celestial recurrences, the day the flowers come and when the birds go. So it's a very short piece, you know, and it's quite ambiguous, I guess, in terms of its meaning. But Larkin gave us a few clues in terms of what he told us it was about anyway. In one interview, he said it was about a time when I stopped keeping a diary because I couldn't bear to record what was going on. I kept a diary for a long time, more as a great grumble book than anything else. And of course, we know Larkin's diaries have got, you know, a very significant part to play in, you know, the kind of history of Larkin post his death. We know that he instructed his secretary Betty McAreth to destroy his diaries, and he was not happy about anyone reading them before then. I mean, there was a famous moment in Belfast when Patsy Strang read his diary, and he went absolutely crazy. I think at the time, according to the account of that. And then when he was ill after his collapse in the library committee meeting in 1961, Monica Jones came up to Hull to see him. He refused to let her stay in his flat in Pearson Park because he had left his papers and diaries around. So they were obviously meant to be, you know, very secret things. But I think probably here he's talking also about the things that you put in diaries, and in the past there were possibly a way of capturing something and then forgetting about it. And in that way it would heal whatever wounds you were feeling about something. It wasn't really working anymore. And it kind of has a literal sense to it, maybe, because in a couple of occasions in letters to Monica, he actually uses the phrase "forget what did," and apparently it's a title that might be loosely based on a novel called "What Katie Did" by Susan Coolidge.
Yeah, famous novel.
You know, and it's about things that you put down there that is it worth putting anything down because it didn't really matter? It wasn't important. He writes, Larkin wrote to Monica in 1950 saying, "Today has been quite devoid of incident. In fact, in the worlds of the old holiday diaries, forget what did, i.e. nothing worth recording." Yeah. You know, and so there is that whole feeling about it not working for him anymore, that diaries perhaps were too painful to want to look back on in that way. You know, it could have that meaning to it. And diaries were something that were quite important to the Larkin family. His father, Sidney, kept a war diary, for example, and also kept these holiday diaries. Every holiday that the Larkins went on, Sidney kept a diary of the little bits and pieces where nothing really happened, actually, when you read them. Kitty and Eva both wrote diaries too. And the ending of the poem.
Yes.
Where he's suggesting that maybe if you are going to fill those blank pages in the future, they record celestial recurrences, the turning of the seasons, perhaps.
So the bland, in a way.
The bland, yeah. And they're kind of universal things.
They're inevitable.
They're just to do with you as an individual. And it made me think about the kinds of diaries that Barbara Pym wrote. Sort of bringing Pym back in, because her diaries are much lighter than Larkin's in some respects. And she had a very different approach to decline and death. And I thought you could make an interesting link here with the theme of many of the poems in High Windows. and actually what would become Larkin's last great poem, Ovid, which came out later. And I've just picked up on a section of a letter that Pym wrote to Larkin in March 1978, after he'd sent her a copy of Ovid. She wrote, "Dear Philip, thank you so much for sending the poem, which fits very well into the blank page at the end of High Windows. I've read it many times with, I was going to say, increasing pleasure and enjoyment, words which may seem inappropriate, but that's the feeling it gives me. I know it will be among the ones I like best, faith healing, ambulances, the building, and of course, Jake Bolosky." And this is the telling point, I think. "When I wake in the small hours, I don't think of death. I always try to switch my thoughts to something frivolous, like clothes or planning a scene in a novel." Now, if only Larkin could have done that.
She used to keep cookery books, didn't she? Recipe books next to her bed, Barbara Pym, if she couldn't sleep. Yeah. It was something.
That was a good idea.
Yeah, really, really good idea. Yeah. Don't think Larkin tried that.
No. But going back to Forget What Did, I think it is an interesting and sort of an ambiguous poem. They said, but apparently Maeve Brennan thought it was written about her. So there's lots in there that Larkin's left in for us to kind of guess about. But
it is about writing about yourself as well, isn't it? That idea of, Chicatrice, it's about turning to stone, isn't it?
It's about how a wound heals. Healing through the way that a scar forms over a wound. Yeah.
I had to look it up, Lynn.
Yeah.
I did too. But, you know, it's no longer doing that. That's the problem for him, in a sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a sort of hint there, I suppose, of where he writes in another poem about his childhood being a forgotten boredom.
Yeah.
You know, there is a kind of emphasis of that kind of thing maybe happening in this poem.
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting poem. It's quite sort of existential, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, again, that's a theme of the volume, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, I don't know. Do you want to go on to the explosion? So that's the very last poem in the collection.
I'll read the poem first, and then So, the explosion. On the day of the explosion, shadows pointed towards the pit head. In the sun, the slag heap slept. Down the lane came men in pit boots, coughing oath-edged talk and pipe smoke, shouldering off the freshened silence. One chased after rabbits, lost them, came back with a nest of lark's eggs, showed them, lodged them in the grasses. So they passed in beards and moleskins, fathers, brothers, nicknames, laughter, through the tall gates standing open. At noon, there came a tremor. Cows stopped chewing for a second. Sun, scarfed as in a heat haze, dimmed. The dead go on before us. They are sitting in God's house in comfort. We shall see them face to face. Plain as lettering in the chapels, it was said, and for a second, wives saw men of the explosion. Larger than in life they managed, gold as on coin, or walking somehow from the sun towards them. One showing the eggs unbroken. So the reason, I think, a bit like yourself, Phil, and a bit like you, Lynn, I chose this because, one, I hadn't really sort of looked at particularly much in the past. And what I first of all found about it, I know that from something I've read that I think he'd seen a documentary, Larkin has seen a documentary on television about a mine disaster. And the first thing on that is that in the 60s and 70s, there did seem to be things on TV about mining disasters and accidents in mines. Of course, a thing of the past generally now in the UK, with so if there are any mines even left. And it felt to me, I feel when I read the poem, it feels very cinematic. documentary, though. I feel it's a black and white documentary. And I find it very moving poem, melancholy, moving. I think it's like an epitaph for the men that have lost their lives and the people that have been affected by this disaster. And when I did a little search about the poem, it's interesting. It's listed on the National Coal Mining Museum.
Is it?
There is
it?
Some, they have a bit about the poems or bits of literature or just generally things that explain about what a Davy lamp was or whatever, and it's listed there and talks about Larkin's. You know, it says on that about potentially he'd seen a news report or a documentary on a mine disaster. There's a couple of things that I particularly like in it. I love the father's brother's nicknames, Laughter. And, you know, there's that sort of camaraderie of, the family, you know, which happened in pit villages and towns where the father went down and the brothers and perhaps the sons, I should say, and the nicknames and the laughter. And I really can visualize and hear them shouting to each other, taking the mickey out of each other, having a laugh on the way to work. And that's what's been then suddenly taken from the explosion that has obviously then killed these men. And that last line for me, I think, is one of a very affecting last line. You know, the one of them had probably the joker in the pack had gone running off and, you know, collected these eggs, and now he's dead, and he's showing the eggs unbroken. There's a sort of sense of afterlife. I might be reading too much into the poem, but so for me, It's as part of the collection, it's not quite as opaque as or obscure, not obscure, but takes as much reading as the other poems. And I think it's a really beautiful poem.
Yeah, I think you're right about it being cinematic in reality. There, I can see that. Yeah. It's a bit like 1914. That's equally cinematic. Mm. And you've got those images going through. You could make a film of it, couldn't you?
Well, one of my great loves is cinema, and as a child, I remember being very affected. And I've not seen the film for many years now. But How Green Was My Valley? Okay. You know, famous novel and a famous film, which I think I might have won an Oscar with Robert Donat and. I think Roddy McDowall, as a young boy who dies a terrible death, and it affected me as an eight-year-old watching it on a Sunday afternoon. And my mother's father's family, you know, came from a pit village in Leicestershire, Ibstock in Leicestershire. And so I'm sure at the time she's saying that's what it was like, you know, you don't know, you never had it so good sort of thing. But I get that visual,
I don't know where I was reading it, whether it might have been under emotion, but I was reading about how it makes you can sort of see the links with To the Sea, which is the opening poem to the collection, where you've got that sense of like a narrative and a community, a close-knit families, sort of poignant kind of poems.
I think Motion's got that right. That To the Sea, again, it's that sense of community, sense of people doing things closely together, be it work, be it whatever, and that comes across in the explosion.
Yeah, I really love this poem. It's one I've always really enjoyed. It reminds me a bit of something again like At Grass as well, you know, where you've just got such a clear that cinematic sort of aspect to it, the clear images, and the final, to choose that final line in his collection, because he spent a lot of time organizing the order of the poems, and so, you know, eggs unbroken at the end, I think is an image of life and positivity. Although actually James Booth points out, if you pick up a nest of eggs, you could actually cause them to not hatch. But I'm not sure if that's what Larkin was thinking about. I like that idea that the kind of the positive symbol of birth.
Some form of hope there.
Yeah, despite. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think if you compare it with To the Sea, the interesting difference here, though, is that with To the Sea, Larkin was basing that poem very much on his own experiences or as told to him by, you know, his parents, because it clearly reflects, you know, what their meeting was about, and seaside holidays and so on that he was either party to or heard about. Whereas here, I think he's dealing with something that, in a sense, is way outside his everyday existence, you know, in terms of this community. So I think it's great achievement to, you know, to be able to get to those emotional qualities so well in this poem.
Yeah.
But I think that's an interesting thing to say about a writer or a poet, because I think if you want to create something different and out of your comfort zone or context, then you need to look at things and pick things. As much as I might use in my writing experiences from my own life, that might form the one line that is the catalyst, but then you're looking to try and utilize other people's experiences to create. So yes, I think he does do.
I think in the letter to Monica, he says, "Don't tell anyone this is about a documentary. I didn't want anyone, like, he didn't want anyone to know. Just watch the documentary."
You can cut that bit out.
Poem. Oh, I've let it out the bag now. Yeah. It's a lovely poem.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
So I picked Livings, and initially I was going to just talk about part one. So Livings is a poem that's in three parts. And when Larkin was struggling to get together a full collection, he kind of called it three poems. And it is almost like three separate poems. But it does have connections in that it's three separate sort of ways of living, three separate professions or lives that he writes about. The first is about like a kind of businessman, a little bit like Friday Night at the Royal Station Hotel. You know, it's the kind of traveling businessman who is trying to keep up his father's line of work and has found himself in this slightly outdated life. And it's set in 1929, which I'll come back to. Part two is a lighthouse keeper, and it seems again like with the explosion, you know, this is something outside, obviously outside Larkin's personal experience, but I think there is a letter somewhere where he writes about liking the idea of being a lighthouse keeper. I think he writes to Monica and says, "How do you get a job as a lighthouse keeper?" You know, it's one of those jobs where you feel like you want to escape from your own life. Being a lighthouse,
hidden away.
Hidden away. That's a pretty good place to go.
Enabled to get on with what you want. There is a famous British, a British black and white film from the Thunder Rock about a lighthouse keeper who's trying to shun what's going on in the world, the Second World War. Gets visitations from sort of like spirits, ghosts, but just people saying you can't hide away.
I think it's James Booth I got this from. He calls it a sublime Mr. Blini poem, which is interesting, you know. So he makes some links with Mr. Blini. And then part three, I think we are going back in time quite a bit further. We're not in the modern days, but we are in sort of academia. And the first line is, "Tonight we dine without the master," which is a line that Larkin did hear when he went to a dinner at Oxford at the university, and I think it struck him, you know, the sort of archaic nature of it, but that was still the life that, you know, people lived at Oxford, and it kind of, he explores that world of maybe an older type of university with butlers, for example, we do end up in a Larkin-esque style, looking up to the sky at the end. So I'll read it anyway, and I'll just say a few things that I found I now like about this poem. Livings, part one. I deal with farmers, things like dips and feed. Every third month I book myself in at the blank hotel in Blankton for 3 days. The Boots carries my lean old leather case up to a single where I hang my hat. One beer and then the dinner, at which I read the Blankshire Times from soup to stewed pears. Births, deaths, for sale, police court, motor spares. Afterwards, whiskey in the smoke room. Clough, Margit's, the captain, Dr. Watterson, who makes ends meet, who's taking the knock, government tariffs, wages, price of stock. Smoke hangs under the light. The pictures on the walls are comic. Hunting, the trenches, stuff nobody minds or notices. A sound of dominoes from the bar. I stand around. Later, the square is empty. A big sky drains down the estuary like the bed of a gold river, and the customs house still has its office lit. I drowse between ex-army sheets, wondering why I think it's worthwhile coming. Father's dead. He used to, but the business now is mine. It's time for change in 1929. Part 2. 70 feet down, the sea explodes upwards, relapsing to slather off landing stage steps. Running suds rejoice. Rocks writhe back to sight, muscles, limpets, husband their tenacity in the freezing slither. Creatures, I cherish you. By day, sky builds grape dark over the salt, unsown, stirring fields. Radio rubs its legs, telling me of elsewhere. Barometers falling, ports, wind shutters shuttered, fleets pent like hounds, fires in humped inns, kippering sea pictures. Keep it all off. By night, snow swerves, O loose moth world, through the stair travelling leather black waters. Guarded by brilliance, I set plate and spoon, and after divining cards. Lit shelved liners grope like mad worlds westward. Part 3. Tonight we dine without the master. Nocturnal vapours do not please. The port goes round so much the faster. Topics are raised with no less ease. Which of Alson looks the fairest? What the wood from Snape will fetch? Names for Pudendum Mulieris. Why is Judas like Jack Ketch? The candle flames grow thin, then broaden. Our butler starveling piles the logs and sets behind the screen a Jordan, quicker than going to the bogs. The wine heats temper and complexion. Oath-enforced assertions fly on roomy fevers, resurrection, regicide and rabbit pie. The fields around are cold and muddy. The cobbled streets close by are still. A sizer shivers at his study. The kitchen cat has made a kill. The bells discuss the hour's gradations. Dusty shelves hold prayers and proofs. Above Chaldean constellations sparkle over crowded roofs. Yeah, so it takes you on quite a journey. So I think I like the first part. I think it's so immediate. You know, it reminds me of things like Show Saturday, you know, and mm-hmm. and you've got the that first line, I deal with farmers, things like dips and feeds. Larkin, again, that was a line Larkin heard and heard that the rhythmic quality to it and thought that would make a great first line for a poem. You know, the lists, I love it. You know, it like the building, like Show Saturday, you've got the list of the births, deaths for sale, police court, motor spares. And
yes,
I love it in part 3, the roomy fevers, resurrection, regicide and rabbit pie. The topics of conversation, lovely rhythms. Mm. You know, it might part 3 reminds me a bit John Betjeman, you know. The fields around are cold and muddy, the cobbled streets close by are still. I think, is it trochaic? Larkin doesn't often write in that kind of rhythm. It's very engaging, I think.
Yeah, the rhymes make it sound very Betjeman.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Absolutely, yeah. So there's lots of references, I think, to other Larkin poems that you can see in this, which I really enjoy as well. Obviously, in part 1, you've got things like, well, I mean, actually in part two, it very much reminds me of Absences. You know, you've got the place at sea that's described in Absences in the Whistle. It's in Lesterseve.
Yes, the Lesterseve.
Yeah, it's in Lesterseve.
Part two has definitely got a sense of the being at sea is a place in Absences in the Lesterseve. Yeah. It's a place where kind of nobody is. That's where Larkin wants to be, a place where even he isn't. Whereas here, we're still, there's those descriptions of the sea, water crashing up at the rocks, I think are amazing, aren't they? Yeah. You know, rocks writhe back to sight. You absolutely can see it. It's so visceral. Yeah. I really love that.
Running suds is lovely.
Running suds,
And again, those sort of everyday objects that Larkin has a relationship with. In Livings 2, the lines that radio rubs its legs, telling me of elsewhere. I mean, Larkin's relationship with the radio was a very ambiguous one. He hated that extraneous noise that radios made, particularly when he was in lodgings. But, you know, he was a great radio listener. And, you know, that was his way of... The poem, of course... Broadcast.
Mm. Yeah.
Where he's at home listening to the concert that Maeve Brennan is attending, you know, this telling me of elsewhere moment.
But isn't that the ambiguity in that as well? Because he's like, you know, radio rubs its legs telling me of elsewhere. So he's keeping everything at arm's length, but actually he's letting
letting it come in
a bit.
Yeah.
When I've read this poem before, Lynn, I've, like you, always thought Livings... Part one is the one that draws you to it, and the others are a bit more distant. But having you read it there, which was great, by the way, all of a sudden that second part that really comes to life. It's you know that crash of, you know, everything going on around. The hideaway,
yeah.
The lighter,
yeah. I like that line, creatures, I cherish you. It's so not what I would see as a Larkin-esque line at all, you know. And that use, we always get told, I bet you got told in your MA just not to use exclamation marks generally, you know, they're very frowned upon.
Ignore it,
because there's three exclamation marks in this poem just on its own, it's just wonderful. And the language in it is so, I love that fires in humped hymns, kippering sea pictures, you know, you know exactly what he means of that kind of bit, a big painting of the sea above the fireplace and all the smoke rising up, gradually kippering this painting, which is just beautiful.
And when you read it out, your lips, your mouth gets all around the words, you know, I know that's, you know, it's on the page, but when you read it, it really makes you work.
It does. Oh, it really does.
It out, that kippering, you know. And pent like hounds, you know, it just,
Pent is such a great word, isn't it? Fleets, pent like hounds. It's very economical in his writing, like lit, shelved liners. Just in three words, you can see those ocean liners at night in their layers of, you know, the layers of the bunks and the, you know, the different... kind of living quarters on the ocean liners, and that image, they grope like mad worlds westward. You wouldn't think of a boat being described as groping, but it works, you know, the way they nose their way through the darkness and through the water. There's so much kind of really exuberant language. Just little things like the divining cards, you know, I love the idea that Larkin would take himself away, be a lighthouse keeper, but take some, maybe some tarot cards with him or something like that. How amazing would that be? You know, it made me think of T.S. Eliot, because obviously there's tarot cards in the Wasteland and the use of cards, divining cards, to sort of, poetry is a way of divining the world, isn't it? You read a poem and you take from it what you see and what you need from it. So I love that he's got that.
I'm available for consultations.
Yes.
Why do you think he blanks out the name of the hotel in Livings 1?
Yeah, it's I suppose it's to try and make it a bit more universal.
The everyman.
The everyman, yeah. That was more of a common feature in writing in the past, wasn't it? Like when they'd blank out swear words and things like that. And a lot of Victorian novels, you'd have the blank, they wouldn't say the name of the town that people go to. Yeah. And also, I know Larkin sometimes said that he preferred his poems to be read, you know, from the book rather than read out loud. So he wouldn't have cared about the fact that it's a bit awkward to say a blank space.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's King's Lynn.
Oh, yeah, King's Lynn.
According to Barbara Everett, who in one of Dale Selwak's books, there's an interview with her, and she said, "I once asked Larkin if it were King's Lynn, and the guess was confirmed." So,
but he's hidden it, hasn't he? Because he's put blank.
He's hidden it deliberately. He's deliberately hidden it. Yeah.
There is I think there is a customs house at King's Lynn. Yeah. Quite it's like a visited place. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine this being in King's Lynn, and you've got like you haven't really got an estuary as such, but you have. There's certainly the square in King's Lynn, in the centre of King's Lynn. And I think again it's James Booth had suggested, you know, the 1929, like the reference to the stock market crash, and that all this was going to come to an end anyway. This way of life was probably going to be, it was already doomed, it was already coming to an end. But I guess again, like the explosion, it's an imaginative leap for Larkin, taking himself and taking us into different worlds. Yeah, and all the language in part three, you know, you have to look up words and understand what they are. But it's it's that very shuttered lifestyle of the old academic world, where a vowson is I think it's a religious role, something to do with the church, like an office. And the same with Sizar. It's a kind of like a Cambridge undergraduate, an Oxbridge undergraduate, but it's archaic language.
Yes, florid sort of language. But it suits the subject. I mean, set up by the first line, "Tonight we dine with the master." Setting it in a time of some, well, not in my experience, that sort of, ancient time or whenever.
I don't think part three is perhaps the most engaging. It's not the most engaging group of people that he's writing about, but I think there's some humor in there, and rabbit pie, regicide and rabbit pie. I mean, that could be that could be a novel by Agatha Christie or something, couldn't it? I might write a book called Regicide and Rabbit Pie.
Getting there quick.
You heard it here first.
And there's stuff in the first and the last, and I suppose in the second, about the constellation, the sky drains down the estuary, the square is empty, a big sky, the sea explodes upwards sort of into the sky in a way, and then the constellations sparkle over crowded. It's a little bit of a thread connecting
absolutely. So maybe we'll hear more about this poem at the conference next year. I mean, I've got a few cuttings from original reviews from 1974, and one very long review is by Alan Brownjohn, and he makes quite a lot about he writes quite a lot about Livings in that review, and I think it must have been, I mean, it must be terrifying to be the person that has to do the review of the new Larkin collection. And it's a big job, isn't it? He talks about the divining cards, and he says, let me just find where it starts. "It is the new emphases which are interesting and which might provide clues as to whether for Larkin the pull of the deep blue air is towards life or death. Ultimately, the most important question to resolve. Clearly new here is the greatly strengthened fascination with the value of habits and rituals. He's never given these things a more arresting dimension. And those three poems, all the poems we've talked about are about habits and habitual and ritualistic behaviour, aren't they? Yeah. And it's all intimately linked with the ways, the places, the times in which Larkin sees life as having meaning and fullness. So what does he see for himself and for us in the divining cards of the thinly disguised lighthouse keeper in Livings? Some old eliminations can be made. The personal past is still something to be unromantically played down. As he says, the wars and winters missing behind the window of an opaque childhood, no deep blue air there. People's mere gregariousness offers nothing of worth. And obviously in this collection, you've got Verda Society, where Larkin says how much he despises, you know, having to make conversation and be sociable. But in Sad Steps and How Distant Youth is a possible justification for happiness, even if Larkin never had it in his time. And nature is again the source of a tentative optimism. Trees tell us begin afresh, afresh and afresh. But this isn't enough. It's really in certain small things, lovingly done, rituals carefully and honourably observed so that death is fended off, even at a funeral in Dublinesque, that some meaning for life is discovered. The hotel visits of the travelling businessman in Livings Part 1, an enthralling poem, are given a marvellous, gentle, haunting illumination. The exhibits and events of Show Saturday are elaborately set out for us in stanzas as crammed and seething as the enclosure with everything assembled in. And he says, regenerate union, let it always be there, which is the last line, isn't it, of Show Saturday. So I really liked what Alan Brown John picked up there, you know, about that's ritualistic behaviour and habits. So I think the conference next year is I think going to be really fascinating when we can we see how people have approached high windows and how I know, because I know I don't think all our contributors have really got high windows at the front of their mind when they've come to this, but I think asking people to focus in that direction, I think will take people into really interesting areas.
I think so, because we picked up on, you know, three poems today that we didn't know particularly well.
No.
And, you know, there are all these blockbusters in there
still. Yeah, yeah.
You just referred to some of them. Yeah. You know, there is a lot here. I think going back to my White Album analogy, there's a lot that you hear on, like, the seventh play or 100th play or whatever. So
yeah,
I think it's going to be a really interesting conference.
It is. It absolutely is. So at the moment, we are still getting papers and coming to us. So we're starting to put the program together now. You know, if people want to know more about the conference, it's the information's all on the website, isn't it, Phil?
Everything
you need is in there. And you know, do get in touch with us if you have something you want to bring along and want to talk about. And then we will be opening it for anyone to register to come along, obviously, as an attendee. Maybe by Christmas. The conference is in the middle of March, the 14th and 15th of March. So hopefully we'll have kind of the registration open around about the end of December, the start of January. And the last conference was really good fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, as an attendee rather than getting involved, it was both myself and my partner just had a great time over those 2 days and immersed in, you know, all things Larkin and all things not Larkin. Away there was lots of other stuff, you know, around, and really enjoying, like, comparing and contrasting back to school, you know, the Larkin and the Ted Hughes poem. It was just
Anyone who's
thinking of coming, they should, because it was excellent, and with it being focused on high windows, it promises to be a treat.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. Yeah, and it was just very convivial, the conference last year, which is what we wanted to make it, and we don't want it to be a dry sort of academic experience. There'll be music. We've got Wes Finch, so there's definitely going to be music.
Oh,
there'll be poetry, not just Larkin's poetry. We are going to have our drinks reception in the art gallery again, which we had last year, which for me was a bit of a highlight.
Which is an undiscovered gem,
Completely, yeah. The art gallery is absolutely astonishing, isn't it? The art collection.
And I'm looking forward to Phil's paper on Larkin as the fifth Beatle.
Yeah,
I'm working that one up. Don't give me any more ideas, Chris. Because I've got so many.
We might have to have the Philip Pullen Larkin conference as its own event. Thank you so much to Chris and Phil for giving their time so generously and for all they're doing around the Larkin Trail and the YouTube account. It sounds like an amazing project. All the many poems, books and films that we mentioned are listed in the show notes, and it is a formidable reading list. If you have an idea for a paper or presentation for next year's conference, then please follow the link to the call for papers, which is on our website. We're not just looking for academic papers, although they are very welcome, but we are also looking for creative and original approaches to Larkin, which we can share and enjoy. And you will be sharing a platform with two of our fantastic honorary vice presidents, writers David Quantick and Blake Morrison, both of whom surely have earned the title of National Treasure. If you fancy coming along as an attendee, then we will open registration in the next month or two, and it's open to all, not just PLS members. A little plug for our society merchandise. We have some fantastic Christmas cards featuring Larkin quotes for sale, as well as our iconic tote bag and other goodies. All purchases help us to put on the podcast, hold events, and continue our work in supporting local and national Larkin-related projects. You can sign up to our mailing list for free or become a fully paid member. It's all very much appreciated. This podcast was produced by me, Lynn Lockwood, and Gavin Hogg, and the music was The Horns of the Morning by The Mechanicals Band. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future topics, then please, as ever, do get in touch.
Of the morning are blowing, are shining. The meadow is wet with the coldest of dew. The dawn reassembles with a clash.